You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Mompós Bolívar. That's 6 hours south from Cartagena, along the Magdalena River, and yes, into the sweltering lowlands of the Caribbean coast. And yes, we are in Colombia, the country with the longest lockdown on Earth at the moment. This is now 140 days, if I'm not mistaken. And yet some of us are going a bit stir crazy. I'm okay here in Mompós with space and help with my children, but there are friends out there who are suffering far more. And of course, those who are in the city or cities with children locked up are immensely under the cosh as well. On this episode, we'll be talking to Dr. Juan Felipe Blanco Libreros, who is an academic and an expert in mangroves and the region of Urabá. That's Urabá Antioqueño. So when you look at Panama and Colombia and follow down the Caribbean side, that big bay, Urabá, there is an amazing area for history, for ecology, environment, and of course, has some very significant role in Colombia's geography. So we'll be talking to him and the challenges that are taking place there. Of course, Dr. Juan Felipe, he helped map the area and map the river. So we're talking to someone who has an unrivaled knowledge of this area of Colombia that so many of us will never and probably won't ever see. So we'll be talking to him in the third segment, and we'll leave you in the capable hands of Emily Hart, who'll be bringing you the newscast with news from this week in Colombia. So don't go away, and we'll be right back with Dr. Juan Felipe Blanco Libreros at the University of Antioquia in Medellin. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for the week of August 17th, 2020. Columbia has now surpassed 15,000 COVID-19 deaths, with recorded cases at over 460,000. Intensive care units are at over 90% capacity in Bucaramanga and Cúcuta, and they are at around 85% capacity in Bogotá, Cali, and Medellín. Lockdowns are being partially reimposed across the country. President Iván Duque gave local authorities relative autonomy to decide when and how to follow up on his economic reactivation plan. Bogotá Mayor Claudia López said on Thursday that she will extend the partial lockdown for another 2 weeks, while other cities like Medellín and Cali are also imposing partial lockdowns as they enter the projected peak of the pandemic. The director of Colombia's Civil Aviation Authority, Aeroservil, said on Wednesday that it will take at least a year to normalise domestic and international air travel, though there are aims to have national flights up and running within 2020. Former President Álvaro Uribe remains in detention following a Supreme Court ruling and pending charges of witness tampering and bribery. He is under house arrest, which his defence team have announced that it will not appeal. Uribe ruled the country from 2002 to 2010 and remained a senator and leader of the hard-right ruling party, the Centro Democrático, up to this year. As of this week, however, Uribe is barred from political activities. In a letter to the Senate, the Supreme Court formally ordered it to suspend Uribe while he is in house arrest. He can only resume his political role if the Supreme Court lifts the house arrest, drops the criminal charges, or absolves him of any crime. After polarised reactions from the Colombian public, with protests both for and against the detentions, various polls have shown that the majority of the country, around 60%, are in favour of Uribe's detention, with around 30% actively opposed. Uribe tweeted a photo of himself displaying his prisoner number, with a suggestion that he was victim to judicial persecution, the manifestation of the influence of the FARC, their new generation, and their allies. Two massacres shook Colombia this week. 9 young people were killed in Samaniego, in Nariño, in the southwest of Colombia, after another massacre of 4 in June. Samaniego has often suffered violence due to its position on narco-trafficking routes between the Cauca and the Pacific coast. The spiral of violence stems from the paramilitary occupation of areas previously dominated by the FARC. Local citizens report that armed groups are taking advantage of the national quarantine to ensure that citizens do not leave their home, guaranteeing impunity for their crimes. It's been suggested by local authorities that the youths were killed for breaking the rules of the paramilitary COVID lockdown. Also this week, five Afro-Colombian children were killed in Cali. It's not clear who is responsible, nor has a meaningful investigation been undertaken. The mayor of Medellin, Daniel Quintero, shook the foundations of the Antioquian establishment this week, taking control of Empresas Públicas de Medellin, EPM, the third largest company in Colombia. EPM is responsible for large amounts of Colombia's industrial infrastructure projects and has been at the center of the model of public-private management in Medellin for decades. A good deal of the Department of Antioquia's budget comes from EPM's profits. Quintero intended to shift the company's purpose and sue the contractors who built Colombia's biggest hydroelectric dam, Hidroituango, for corruption during its construction. The entire board of EPM has now resigned, creating a crisis in both management and confidence. The company remains at a standstill. That was this week's News Bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is Colombia. Final segment of our show this week. We're talking to, PhD Juan Felipe Blanco Libreros, and he's a professor at the Institute of Biology of the University of Antioquia. And his expertise, and he's quite the explorer, his expertise is the region of Urabá. Now, for those of you who don't know where Urabá is, it's in that wedge of the country between Panama and Colombia's Caribbean coast, and it's an area of outstanding natural beauty and, of course, all sorts of fascinating scientific discoveries are being made in the area. But I shouldn't talk about this because, well, we've got Juan Felipe here, and this is his beat. This is what he wants to talk about. And he got in touch with us to say, listen, I'd love to talk about Urabá and the mangroves and this area and the outstanding features and why it's important. So I'm just going to hand it over to Juan Felipe Blanco Libreros and say thank you for agreeing to come on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Thank you, Richard, for saying yes to my email. I came across your email through Twitter by chance on the chapter about Darien history. I just love it. And I said, well, I should talk about Urabá as well in order to continue this travel along the Darien Urabá region. So thanks a lot for inviting me to the show.
You're most welcome. We've done quite well in recent weeks. We've done the three episodes on migrants crossing the Darien Gap. We've had the Pacific Coast with Shauna Gilluli, and we've had the history of the Scottish settlements in Darien. And so it's all connected. And Urabá is a nice way of kind of closing that off, let's say. But so tell us, I mean, you're in Medellin and you're born in Medellin, but your roots are from San Onofre, Sucre, and Barranquilla. So you have costeño roots. But I've been up to Urabá and I'm like, this isn't totally costeño here. This has, you know, costeño mixed with Antioquia and mixed with, let's say, the Chocó and everything else. Tell us a little bit about the history and the people who live and where Urabá is.
Yeah, Urabá is a quite interesting area because it is in the crossroads of the Pacific along the Atrato River. So we have Black African descendants immigrants, mostly emancipated slaves since the 1800s. Then we have also indigenous people, communities, the Kunas, mostly related with the Darien area. They were the Native Americans or the First Nations, as in Canada they are called. Then we have the Spaniard colonization and the Antioqueños recolonizations back in the early 19th. And then we have also colonization from Cordoba and Cartagena. So we have quite a mix of people. And now with the increase of the banana growing business, we have visitors from all over the world. Urabá is one of the main growing areas of banana. So it is the main producing area. And then we have Magdalena, mostly known by the Garcia Marquez histories. So we have quite a mix of people in Urabá nowadays.
It's incredible, really, when you think about it, we say the indigenous, the traditional, original inhabitants, the Kuna, and I'm sure along the Atrato River is different indigenous families. And then you said the emancipated black slaves. And then, of course, you've got your colonos from, let's say, Antioquia, and then other costeños drifting in. And if you're coming, people from Cordoba, I would suggest that there's probably some people of Lebanese descent, because a lot of migration from, as they say, Turcos, but Lebanese people from the Ottoman Empire. But, you know, what I mean, for the first thing that really interests me, and we've done a lot of history on this show, is the first Spanish settlements, which failed, of course, were in that area. I did a story many, 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 many years ago, I think in 2007 or 2008, about the settlement by Alonso de Ojeda up there near to Necoclí. And I went up, and I was just blown away by the beauty of the area. But when you try and imagine a Spaniard in the, I guess it was 16th century, trying to settle and make a colony in this area, again, outstandingly beautiful, but so very difficult. Tell us about the geography of this area, the nature.
Yeah, the area where Alonso de Ojeda first set foot is close to the current-day Necoclí, which is the northern tip of the Urabá Gulf. It's kind of the entrance from the Caribbean Sea. It is a transition from the coastal plain to the foothills of the Abibe Serranía. So it has kind of a hot climate, very, very, very hot, rainy in some times of the months of the year, swampy. So nowadays it is pretty developed, a lot of fincas or farms, but at that day it should be kind of full of swamps, rainforest, jungle, and as well as of course on some clear areas by the indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. So it is supposed that this settlement was nearby Necoclí in the uphills, but there are no remains right now. Mm-hmm. It probably was a fortress rather than a permanent settlement founded in 1509, probably, and it lasted less than a year, according to the chronicles. And then it seems by the repeated siege by indigenous people, Ojeda just fled to the other coast of the Urabá, to the Darién, and then he found Santa María la Antigua del Darién about 1510. Yeah,
it's amazing. I mean, the history of this conquistador is amazing, and that his expeditions included or have reference to Cortés, Hernán Cortés, and have reference to Fernando Pizarro as well. So those of you who know your history will know that Pizarro is the guy who got to Peru and Cortés, Mexico. So, I mean, think of the connectivity between these guys. And I know that he was the first guy, Alonso de Ojeda, to set his eyes on the area of Cartagena as well. But he was a pretty awful man. And in his death, and we'll close off this section on history, but in his death, he reflected on his life and asked to be buried under the steps of the old cathedral in Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. I believe that cathedral has fallen down in an earthquake, so that people could step on him when they were going into church. I mean, so there you go. I mean, let's talk about reflecting on a life poorly lived, I guess. But so, I mean, we talk about this. I mean, the nature was perhaps his greatest enemy at this time. When he's there, I mean, we're looking at the jungles, the wet, and of course, all the nature in there—the snakes, the mosquitoes, with all the different diseases. But you know this really. I mean, this area incredibly well. And moving on from that, I mean, we know it's mangrove swamps and mangroves are protected the world over, and they are this incredible barrier between the sea and the land. I would only assume that the mangrove swamps are at risk up in Urawa of being cut down or being eroded? Is there a real environmental problem?
Yeah, we have in Urawa kind of two sides of the story. Similarly to the story of the colonia and the conquest that started in the east coast and ended in the west coast, we have more development on the east coast nowadays. That's where the banana plantations and most of the rural area has grown. We have the major coastal settlements there. They were established by the mid 1800s. So this area has been very, very, very damaged. We have mangroves in some deltas or river mouths. Some of them remain in good conditions, and others have been transformed extensively due to the cattle ranching, the expansion of the agricultural frontier. In some areas are related with the deforestation or clearing by the banana growers. But then we move to the southern part and the west area, and we have these huge mangrove areas with tall trees, with extensive swampy areas. And that reminds me that that was probably the landscape that the conquerors and the colonos faced when they first set foot. So it's kind of two stories, as I said. It's the urban, rural area, kind of 21st century. And then we have still 1600s or you know, the colony times landscape is still in the 21st century. So we have the urban and the wild.
I'm fascinated by this area, and I say it often on my podcast, where I did I not have two children and a wife, I'd be up there a lot more and doing some exploring and more articles. But you spent a significant amount of time up there, and you were part of, or you were involved in, the scientific expedition in 2009-2010. Can you tell us about this expedition and what it hoped to, or what it did achieve?
Yeah, it was kind of my early career project. And when I returned to Colombia after finishing my PhD, I got a tenure track position in Universidad de Antioquia. And it was a perfect time when the governor in the house at that time was planning to celebrate the bicentennial of Antioquia, which was 2013. And then he and the former vice rector of research at the university planned an expedition. So, like, and then they were coming up with different ideas. They said to the academics, well, just propose what you want to do. And there were, you know, hundreds of proposals. Of course, as a mangrove ecologist or coastal ecologist, in my background, I said, well, let's try exploring the Urawa area. It was poorly known from the scientific point of view at that time, a few papers, a few technical reports. But I was aware that the Atrato River was discharging the waters there. So there was a huge delta. But the cartography was very, very bad. So we have in some areas kind of straight line, which means that the base maps or the satellite images or aerial photographs were very bad in resolution. So we came along with colleagues from Universidad de Afid, Universidad Nacional de Colombia, a bunch of geographers, geologists, marine biologists, and botanists, and zoologists. And we said, well, we first want to map the area with aerial photographs and then explore the area for biological, zoological, and botanical surveys. So we were funded, our project was funded, and then we started the expedition. It was a 2-year expedition. It was planned to be 5, but then we have a shift in the governor house. You know, this project was over. Since that, I've been alongside with my colleagues trying to to keep on exploring on their different funding schemes and all that.
Yeah. Oh, right. And it's supposed to be 5 years, and you would have done a total mapping and a total revision of everything there. But in 2 years, I'm sure you were still able to achieve a great deal, not as much as you'd like, but a great deal. I mean, if you, as you said, like on the maps, it was just straight lines. I've got a theory that the only real and effective and quality maps that exist in Colombia are in fact military maps. so once you came out of this expedition, what could you tell the people about Urabá that they didn't already know?
Well, first of all, that there were this huge amount of mangroves in some areas that were not fairly well known. Then the other thing was that we were surprised about the low richness of the species, both of invertebrates and plant species associated to mangroves. Mangroves worldwide are known for being the area of high biodiversity, but it was the other side around in Urabá. And I've been diving in the Caribbean, in mangrove swamps and lagoons, and as you probably know, and people in the audience have known, we can see these huge aggregations of sponge and sea stars, oysters, and all that crawling around the mangrove roots, hanging from the mangroves into the water. But it was the opposite in Urabá area. So our hypothesis of finding a very diverse area was just wiped out. And we said, well, we cannot longer ride the flag of conservation based on richness or biodiversity, as we call Colombia, Colombian white. So we start thinking about what should be the reason of that. And the reason came out was that the Atrato River just pours so much fresh water that makes that this huge gulf may freshen during part of the year. And then this area becomes kind of a freshwater lagoon. It's not a freshwater. It's brackish or low salinity, which may block the entrance of marine fauna into this area during parts of the year. Or if they enter during a part of the year where the salinity is higher, they will be wiped out when the rainy season comes back. So this is a huge area, but it's fairly different from the rest of the Caribbean. So it is very special in terms of conservation. What you find here, you cannot find it elsewhere in the Caribbean, either in the Colombian side or the Panamanian side. So we have very extensive mangrove areas, but they are mostly monospecific. They are kind of pine plantations. It's a rough comparison, but it's like amazing. You go everywhere. We have 80% the same species, which is fairly special in mangroves worldwide. But on the other side, you have that these few species that enter in the area just flourish. Then you have huge mangrove trees. You have huge amount of fish. You have huge amount of low salinity tolerant crabs and shrimps and snails and all that. So you have what you call in ecology high primary productivity. So a huge amount of energy entering into the system and flowing through all creatures living in there. So that's Urabá, the area of the very special mangrove ecosystems.
I absolutely love this information that you've given us. The idea of the Atrato River being so big and powerful and emptying out the fresh water into the Gulf of Urabá and changing the ecosystem of the mangroves, it's not pollution. It's a natural course, this fresh water. So the mangroves have adapted to this.
Yes, it is. Mangroves have adapted over millions of years from the origin site in the Pacific, crossing all over the tropical coast, ending up in America, but they are just low salinity tolerant, contrary to the rest of terrestrial trees. So the lower the salinity, the better for them. In the case of Uraba, let me recap a little bit. Then we have this the result of the past history is a geological history. Rivers in Colombia in the Pacific drain it all the way to the Ocean Pacific, but then when we have the rise of the Panama Isthmus, the Atrato River turned to the Caribbean, and then you have this huge amount of fresh water from a Pacific river draining into the Caribbean, which is more saline. And then the Southern Caribbean, where the Uraba Gulf is located, became just a fresh water area, a Pacific-like nature. And then, of course, we have a geological connection to the Pacific.
That's incredible. That's incredible. I mean, I am learning a great deal right now. But so, I mean, we know about the nature now. We've learned a bit more about what's going on, what you know, naturally, the natural environment. I mean, it's clearly a very delicate, very special area, protected, of course. What worries me about Uraba is that it's Antioquia's exit to, you know, international exit to the oceans. And so it's always, whenever I read anything political from, let's say, the governor of Antioquia or whomever is in power, it's like the next big development will be a port, maybe in Uraba or something. I don't know if it can happen. I don't know if it's deep enough. But this idea that Antioquia is the industrial hub of Colombia and then Uraba will be its exit to the world. And what do you think? Is this something that could happen?
Yeah, I see it more feasible day by day. I've been in Antioquia over the last 15 years, and with the different shift in governor, I have seen the same speech. The best corner of America, the exit to the Caribbean, to the sea. And of course, it is grounded on reality. We right now have the largest banana growing area, is global producer, exporting to Europe, to the United States. So there's a reason for thinking about international trade in Uraba area. The thing is that the investments have not been really probably planned. So we don't not only need ports, we need roads in order to connect Medellin and Bogota with this area. So there's where you have the gap between plans and reality. With the proposal of these huge highways that started like 8 years ago, the things start improving. So we see day by day growth in economic development in terms of infrastructure in Uraba. And of course, now we have the proposals of three ports. Antioquia Port is the largest, will be located in the southern part of the Gulf. Yeah, it has environmental licensing. So they are in the look for investors. Then we have two ports, one in the city area of Turbo, which probably be a smaller commerce port. And then there's a third port plan in the Cocli, which is going through two major revisions. Then there are plans. And of course, there are plans of disgorgement. I don't know if they are going to be really started to be constructed during this period. But the thing is, there's interest in Uraba. But on the other hand, there's interest just from the development side, not from the conservation side or the social development. So we have this Uraba region as the third contributor to Colombian economy, which is huge. If we think in Colombia, and we think in coffee growing, and we think in petroleum, so after that, we have Uraba. So we have this huge richness and wealth, and then this huge inequality. So we have huge banana plantations with international trade and all that. And then we have slums in Turbo. We have poor fishermen communities along the coast, product of forced displacement due to the armed conflict in the Atrato, in Cordoba. So it's a region of many contrasts. Huge wealth, natural richness, but then poverty due to inequalities.
That's one of the I find that as being almost universal in Colombia, where natural wealth, but also at the same time the huge inequalities found between I would say big companies, and then of course the local farm or local settlers who displaced for the economic benefit. Now that kind of brings me in, you've kind of been drawing me towards it, is that we have to talk a bit more about the contemporary times in Urabá, because anyone who knows anything about it will know that it's often in the news for all the wrong reasons, not for the environmental side and the mega diverse elements that we've discussed. I mean, Urabá, as you said, bananas, as we know, cattle farming, as you said as well. Are there palm plantations as well?
Yeah, palm plantations have been promoted over the probably past 5 years. And then palm plantations are established in former cattle ranch.
Okay.
So that area in Carepa and Chigorodó, which is in the southern part of the Urabá region, are being transformed with the palm business. There are some areas in the northern part, mostly over the Caribbean Sea, but then we have the central part dominated by the banana growing district. There are other small businesses like yuca or cassava. There are pineapple enterprises, mostly for processing, associated also with the banana business. And then there are some interest in biodiesel, more industrial-like development from agricultural business. Mm. So I think that's pretty much the economy of the Urabá region is agricultural-like, raw product or produce, and then a little bit of industrialized processes.
It's and of course, let's say when you were doing your expedition and when you've been up to these areas, you know, Turbo is a city or a big town that worries me immensely when I go there. I've only been a couple of times and I'm always like, oh. But Necoclí, when I was doing my investigations up there, I was sometimes told to be a bit more careful about who I talk to. Have you run into problems up there? Because we know it's an area with the banana zone in the beginning. I mean, you're looking at ELN, and then you're looking at the guerrillas, and then you were looking at FARC, and then it was paramilitaries. And we know about the international story of, I guess it was Chiquita Black Brands paying protection money. Have you had trouble up there? Have any of your researchers had trouble?
No. I've been fortunate not getting into trouble. Of course, we try to make good relationships with local communities. So even when we started the expedition 10 years ago, we hired an anthropologist. We based on the resources of the university in Turbo. We have a branch there. So we hired former students of marine sciences there. Who know the territory. Also, we alerted the Coast Guard and all that. But then we were like announced about our purposes and motives and all that. In addition to that, we also have to announce to the African descendant communities that we are going to be there. We have to negotiate in order to get permission and all that. So we were crystal clear about our purposes, and I always try to do so in order to not get into trouble. However, of course, there are kind of small issues sometimes when we go into places and we have not been announced, and then we have to explain nations and all that. But never sort of rough. Of course, we have seen this kind of paramilitary or drug dealers, but just friendly talks and all that, and that's it. So we've been fortunate. So I mean, there's this interesting anecdote. When we were riding by boat the coast of the Caribbean coast, we already completed the Gulf part of the trip. Once we turned Necoclí, it was open sea in the to the north, and then we have the Caribbean coast to the south. And the boatman started receiving calls. And he was saying, yeah, we are with the people of the university, of the expedition. Yeah. And then after some minutes and a few calls, I asked him, who's calling you? And he said, some people from the coast. When we just disembarked in mangrove areas, river mouths and all that. But what I mean is that we were watched. Despite we were clear of our purposes and all that. And it was like a 2-day trip. And then it ended in our bulletins. But probably the take-home message is that when you go to do research in these areas, you have to be clear about your purposes. Talk to as many people as you can, locals. And then the boost the word of mouth, you want up to the people of interest that will let you or not to get in. Of course, in some areas we have not entered because we have been said it's too dangerous, don't go there. Recently, I fly drones for mapping, and I have been said you have to lower your drone. So you get your toy back home. So that's Urawa. You learn to live with that.
Yeah,
and adapt.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, you talk about drones, you remind me of the tragedy of the geologists in Cauca last year, of course, who were mapping parts of that department and were killed for mapping. Of course, Cauca is a different story as well, but Urabá is complex. Urabá is, I mean, you've explained it to us very completely. It's complex up there. And I always think of the geography of Colombia. It's that it's a highway. It's a highway that, you know, from the south, Cauca and these areas, Medellin and all the way up. It's one straight line for anything that you want to ship out of Colombia, illicit or legal, it's one straight line, and so it sits right there. As we round this down, I mean, we've talked about many many topics and many points of interest that surround this area. But I mean, you've talked that most people sort of, I guess, campesinos, who I like to say is country folk or small farmers. I don't like the translation of peasants, but country folk or small farmers, just it's subsistence farming and subsistence artisanal fishing and so on. And then you've got the big multinational, let's say some palm, some bananas, some cattle or big things. What is the, I mean, is there real socioeconomic progress on the ground for the local people, or is Urabá condemned to remain somewhat of a backwater?
Yeah, I would start with the end statement. I wouldn't say it's condemned. I neglect to think about that.
Yeah.
I just cannot accept it is going to be forever like that. Yeah. But of course, we see little progress. And probably it is because there's no interest from the big interest in a more equal development, or simply there's no interest at all. Then I think AIDS programs, the university with the education objectives may improve the livelihoods of the people. Now we are seeing these boards of community-based organization, they are kind of working on not only propose new ways of development, more empower. The Catholic Church is there with programs, also their international aid. So I think people are trying to improve their livelihoods by themselves, despite of the back turning from the government or the big companies. So I hope this might improve, because there's no way this could be continued this way. Yeah. Otherwise, it's condemned.
Well, and also, why would we work on it? But if there's no hope, we wouldn't work on it. You know, we work on these things to try
to matter. Yeah.
Yeah. And the issue with the killings of social and community leaders is bad up there as well in Urawa?
It's not that bad, but it has touched some of the communities we work with. Boca de la Trato, for instance, which is the black Afro-descendant community with land rights. Mm. So it was too bad to listen about that.
Yeah.
But, well, we don't know the reasons at the end. But it is calmer right now. So it's kind of different. The situation is worst in the uplands, more into the mountains regions, and in the Atrato, of course, the headwaters of the Atrato.
Tell me, so I mean, you've talked so comprehensively around this area, and we've talked on social issues, we've talked about the nature, the science, the history, the industry. What's next for you? I mean, you've studied this area. What's your next project? Are you going to be doing further work on Urawa?
Yeah, that's my plan. And I think it's kind of a moral mandate as a scientist. So we produce knowledge, and that knowledge should be put into the table for changing realities, for helping development, to guide policy making. And my purpose right now, and we are kind of alongside with different researchers at the university, we want to produce, you know, educational resources for communities, for ethno education, for the schools, either from primary or secondary schools, in order to improve lives or more empowering people. Mm. So it's not just producing books and writing English papers. That's fine for me, but that's kind of selfish. So I think this knowledge should translate into something that may change realities. And part of that was the proposal of an ordinance that was signed last year for protecting mangroves with integral actions. So I think the next step is going more into applying research to solve problems in many areas. Even if it is economic progress, of course, sustainable, social, equally, or just, we need to do business for a living. So we cannot say no to development. We have to propose new ways to do business.
Yeah. I like this very much. I like that, you know, the idea is that the work being done is actually read and it gets out there to evoke change and improvement, not just sitting on a shelf gathering dust in an academic library somewhere. The idea is that this knowledge is shared and empowers the people. I think that's the key message here, that we need to empower the local people and draw awareness to these areas of massive inequality, but just so much opportunity and environmental outstanding environmental benefits, not only to Colombia, but I would say globally so in this circumstance. So let me take this moment to say thank you so much to Juan Felipe Blanco Libreros, PhD professor of the Institute of Biology at the Universidad de Antioquia there in Medellin. It's been a really fascinating talk about this area, which is largely unknown, I would say, not only by the world, but also by Colombians themselves. So thank you again for getting in touch and agreeing to talk on the podcast.
Thank you, Richard, for this opportunity. It was great chatting. It's been kind of a great follow-up for your previous shows. episode. And yeah, it's been educational. Many people in Colombia think Urabá is not part of the Caribbean, that Antioquia is not part of the Caribbean, that the Caribbean coast of Antioquia is Capurganá, which is in Chocó, or Coveñas, which is in Córdoba. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
You're most welcome. This has been a really, really interesting conversation to enlighten us and educate us a little bit more about Colombia and kind of close off what feels like a segment or a few months that we've focused on the coast in Colombia. So we've had the Darien Gap and we've had the Pacific coast and we've had some history on the Darien. Now we've had the Urabá Caribbean side. I mean, it's pretty cool to be able to cover all of this and get experts in each one to talk about them. So that's me, Richard McCall, closing out this episode 336 with Juan Felipe Blanco Libreros, PhD professor of the Institute of Biology at the University of Antioquia. As always, as I say every week, please stay safe, self-isolate, heed the warnings. You know, we're all in this together. Colombia is still increasing in its levels of contagion of COVID-19, and we really need to work with one another in order to get out of this and to move on forwards. And so that's my message for today. And a very special thank you to my guest again. This has been episode 336, and I've been Richard McCall for Colombia Calling here in Mompox, Bolivar. Thank you again. Bye-bye.